Hello and welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of Episode 8 in the series, which is Part 1 of a conversation with ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. Like the existing president of the United States, Ray is a New Yorker. He's not an upstate small town or rural New Yorker, but a New York City native. In fact, both Ray and Donald are Fordham University guys. But Donald dropped out of Fordham. The most respected Washington, D.C. journal, Politico, says that Trump, and I'm quoting Politico, "Trump spent only 2 years at Penn, having transferred to Wharton as a junior from Fordham in New York City. He was hardly a stellar student, never making the dean's list, despite repeatedly telling the New York Times he graduated first in his class. So I'm glad we're with an honest guy today who tells the truth." Ray, by the way, stayed on and graduated with honors from Fordham. Years later, Ray McGovern would work in the White House as a CIA analyst and morning briefer for George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush administration. McGovern was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. In the 1980s, he chaired the National Intelligence Estimates and prepared the president's daily briefing. He received the Intelligence Commemoration Medal at his retirement, returning it, however, in 2006 to protest the CIA's involvement in torture. Ray, this is a great pleasure having you with us today. Let's kind of start from the beginning. And, you know, if you could tell us, Ray, about your upbringing, you know, a little bit about your family and where you went to school, would love to hear that.
Well, I was born in the Bronx 1 week before Hitler invaded Poland. So I was alive during all of World War II, which was the formative experience for me and led to my extreme patriotism for the first couple of decades of my life. I went to Fordham University because I could walk to school, and I had a basketball scholarship, incidentally, that paid my tuition. And I took a major in Russian language, literature, history, pursued a master's degree in the same area. And when I heard about the CIA and that it had an analysis group whose function was to tell the president without fear or favor what's going on in the world, and that would have access to all information that the government possessed on whatever issue, that sounded really, really good to me. So I recruited myself, I passed the interview, and they said as long as I could complete my military service, I was in Army ROTC, and I was commissioned as an infantry intelligence officer. As long as I finished that, then I could come and work with the CIA in the analysis division on Soviet foreign policy, it turned out. So I wound up down in Washington on active duty, and then in April of 1963, while John Kennedy was still president, I started my service with the CIA and focused on Soviet foreign policy, particularly with respect to China and with respect to Indochina. Those were the big areas of the day, and I felt very fortunate to be able, really, to tell the president and other advisors what I thought about Sino-Soviet relations, for example, and not have anyone doctor what I came up with, as long as my grammar and syntax was okay, and as long as my superiors thought I was on the right analytical track. The president would be reading what I wrote, not every day, obviously, but maybe every 6 weeks or so. It was a very, very heady experience.
Were you actually reading Pravda and Izvestia, since you majored in Russian? How did you glean your information about the Russians and the Chinese and Vietnam, etc.?
Well, Jack, I'm going to reveal a trade secret right now, so don't let it go out of this room, okay?
All right, yeah.
And that is that in those days, about 75 to 80% of the information we needed to figure out whether the Russians and Chinese really hated each other or not, or whether it was a big facade, was in open media. Now it's the case that about 90% of the information you need on any given issue or country is available in open media. Now, does an intercepted message or a satellite photo help every now and then? You bet it helps. But it usually serves as confirmation of analytical conclusions that you've already arrived at. For example, there were people in Washington, including in the CIA, who refused to believe that Russia and China, both being communist countries, were really at loggerheads, that they really hated each other. It was all a big facade. So we had to fight that battle. And then one time, the satellites dumped a bunch of film in the Pacific. The Navy caught it and was brought to Rochester. And when the analysts that CIA sent up there to evaluate what was photographed in these satellites, when they came back to Washington, one of them said, "Ray, you're going to be very happy with what we found." And I said, "Oh, what's that?" "We found 15 Soviet Army divisions on the Chinese border." Now, we didn't get much argument that the Russians were really at loggerheads with the Chinese after that. But the main thing here is that you can pretty much make your judgments if you have enough experience and know how to read the public statements. You can make judgments and come out with the right answer without sexy information from spies or from sophisticated technical collection devices.
You know, just a couple of months after you came on with the CIA, this would be April of 63, is that right, when you started?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. It was June 10th of 1963 that John Kennedy made that famous speech at American University that has been pretty well publicized, especially by James Douglas, with his book, The JFK, The Unspeakable. JFK was calling pretty much for detente. Do you have any memories of what the buzz was in the CIA at the time as JFK was promoting, and would die, of course, not too many months after, promoting the idea of improved relations with the Soviets?
Well, sure. I mean, as a Soviet foreign policy analyst, we were shocked that Khrushchev authorized the publication of that entire speech in Pravda and Izvestia. It was a first. In other words, it struck a very responsive chord. You know the rest of the story. You mentioned James Douglas's book on the JFK assassination. It's the best rendering, its first 100 pages, of how John Kennedy reached out to Khrushchev and they made a deal. And they did a limited test ban treaty and had all kinds of progress in store when Vietnam came along after, and when actually John Kennedy was assassinated. That put things back. That was a tragedy of monumental proportions. He was working things out with the Soviets. LBJ either didn't want to or didn't know how. And so we got Vietnam and all the things that flow from that.
You know, can I just ask you this very blunt question? Who was responsible for his assassination? Very often, you know, the CIA is involved, the mafia is involved, some of the top brass, the military is involved. After all these years, do you have a sense of who killed John Kennedy?
I do, yeah. It's pretty simple to me. It was a combination of what we now call the deep state. It was the CIA, portions of the FBI, the military. If you read James Douglas' book called JFK and the Unspeakable, you get the best rendering of what actually went down. I've read a lot of them. And of course, James Douglas is one of the more recent ones. I guess it's about 10 years old now. But it's a very good rendering of all the evidence, and the evidence points to the fact that the CIA was involved and that even portions of the Secret Service were involved. It's a very detailed analysis, And I think the proof is in the pudding. When Alan Dulles, who, by the way, had been cashiered by Kennedy because of Dulles's lying about the Bay of Pigs operation, you don't cashier a Dulles brother without suffering consequences. So what Alan Dulles did was orchestrate this thing, and then he insinuated himself onto the Warren Commission. Now, when Alan Dulles got himself appointed pretty much the head of the Warren Commission, the others were not really experienced at all this, he was able to select all the witnesses and you know, sort of shape the thing the way he wanted it. And there were a few people in the press that said, wait a second. We think that the CIA might have been involved in this thing. And guess what Alan Dulles said? Conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory. And Jack, it worked.
Yes.
Now, that's the first use that I'm aware of this way of dismissing people who are actually trying to find real answers to questions. You call them conspiracy theorists and you diss them. And that's going on today, as you will recognize with the Russiagate thing, where a lot of us are very, very skeptical that the legend about Russian hacking into the DNC can stand up to close scrutiny.
Yeah, I think that's a question we're going to be asking you a bit later on in this program. But coming back in a sort of a rough chronology of the period, as you think back of Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Bush 1, you worked under all these guys after Kennedy. There's so many issues that, you know, we would probably have to spend a week of interviews to get into this in any depth. But what are some of the briefings of that time? And what can you tell people listening to this podcast about issues that, you know, I don't know how much you can say about what it was classified, secret or top secret, but what comes to mind, you know, of this broad spectrum of seven presidents? I mean, that's probably too big of a question, but pick one or two areas where you might want to say something.
Well, let's do Vietnam. When we came on board in late 63, early 64, the U.S. was getting involved big time in Vietnam. Many of the officers that I trained with at Fort Benning the year before never came back. There was an immediacy to the whole thing. And a friend of mine from the same training class, his name was Sam Adams. Actually, he was a direct descendant of John Adams, 32 times removed or whatever. He was a bright guy. He was a... actually, Harvard graduate, served in the Navy for 3 years, went to Harvard Law School, didn't like that much, and was very interested in joining the ranks of CIA analysts. He liked the idea of having access to all the information that the government had on a given subject and being able to speak with truth of power, unlike the folks that work at the Pentagon and, for example, have to make the Russians out to be 10 feet tall, or the people in the State Department who have to defend their own policies. We were independent, and we were able to tell the people above us what was going on without fear or favor. So here Sam Adams comes in, and I'm working on Russian policy toward Vietnam. Sam was working on Vietnam itself, and he found out through painstaking analysis, and he was the best, that the communists had under arms in South Vietnam twice as many troops as General Westmoreland, head of the American forces in Saigon and Vietnam, would admit to. Mm-hmm. Now, Sam was no dope. You know, he was really smart. So he went over his findings, and he told me. He said, "This is really bizarre. General Westmoreland will not let anyone say there are more than 399,000 communists in South Vietnam when I know there are 500 to 600,000. So he was sent over to Saigon and did battle with the people who were counting Vietnamese communists. And he couldn't figure out how a battalion that he knew had 120 people, the people at MACVI, the military command there in Vietnam, would only carry half that. So finally, he's in a bar one night while he's there in Saigon, and one of the sergeants has a couple too many beers. He comes there, Mr. Adams, and says, look, Mr. Adams, you might as well just go home. General Westmoreland won't let us go over 299,000, and that's it. He just won't accept any more troops. So we have all the battalions and the regiments. So Sam figured out what was going on. What was going on was that Westmoreland was giving out these kill figures every week. We killed 3,565 communists. And, you know, the press in Saigon, I mean, they weren't geniuses, but they could do arithmetic, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's no way that Westmoreland could say, well, we started with 300,000 and we killed these many people over the months. And so we still have, now we have 350,000. In other words, it was a bunch of lies. So Sam came back and he reported, and he gathered everyone in the intelligence community behind his views, except the army, of course, with General Westmoreland in charge. And he did an estimate saying there are at least 500,000, 600,000 troops under arms. And so you ought to know that, Mr. President. Now what happened? Well, the director of Central Intelligence, the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, in his wisdom, said to Sam Adams, Sam, we can't tell the president that. And Sam says, what do you mean we can't tell him? He says, well, look, my job as head of the CIA is to protect the agency. And I can't protect the agency if I get involved in a pissing war with the head of the army now at war. So you're right, Sam, but we can't tell the president this. Wow. Now that was unusual, but the story there, the point is simply we did our job, we did an honest estimate, but there are always people at the top that want to play a political game. And Director Helms thought that it was more important to avoid a fracas with the U.S. Army at war than to tell the president the right answers to this question. Another thing on Vietnam, very briefly, LBJ was told at the beginning of the conflict by the Air Force generals, you know, the blue-suited guys. They say, now, Mr. President, and he came to us, he said, now, these blue-suited guys, they all say that we can, we have these great big bombers called B-52s, and they have great big bombs, and we're gonna bomb Ho Chi Minh Trail and stop the flow of insurgents and arms down into South Vietnam. What do you guys think? Well, we knew what was going on. We knew the history of bombing, and we knew, most important, Ho Chi Minh. Some of the people working with me carried Ho Chi Minh into Hanoi after World War II, after the North Vietnamese communists had gotten rid of the Japanese, okay? We knew that Ho Chi Minh is not going to give up, least of all under bombing. And we also knew, and we told the president this after a decent interval of 2 days, we said, now, Mr. President, you have to realize the Ho Chi Minh Trail, it doesn't look anything like I-95 or the 5 out there in California or I-66. It's like 165 trails that we've identified. There are probably more through the jungle. We can't even see it from the canopy. And so there's no way, no matter how many B-52s you have or no matter how many bombs you have, there's no way you can seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The teaching point here is that you can do all honest analysis, as we did, and told LBJ that he couldn't seal off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, But the president has other prerogatives, has other considerations. He didn't want to be the first U.S. president to lose a war. And so he did not heed our advice. He went with the blue-suited generals, and, well, he became the first U.S. president to lose a major war.
You're listening to Episode 8 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Part 1 of a conversation with ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of this episode. You know, the turning point, though, was the Tonkin Bay resolution. And what did the CIA know about that? I mean, that's what really allowed the almost complete destruction of North Vietnam. What did the CIA have on that? They must have known some of the lies involved.
On Tonkin, this is another disgrace, okay? We knew that there was no incident, or that there was very flimsy evidence of an incident in the Tonkin Gulf on the 4th of August, the second day when there was an alleged attack. First day, there was an attack, but nobody got hurt. Second day, well, the initial information was denied by the commander out there in Honolulu, and they told NSA, look, don't go with that. Now, what happened? Well, I can tell you this, that we who prepare the president's daily brief and other daily publications were told not to report that there was no second attack. Now, who told us that? A deputy director came down and told my colleague, President Johnson has decided to use this to start a war. We're not going to tell him the truth. What happened the next morning? The next morning, by his own admission, McGeorge Bundy, who was the national security advisor to Johnson, is sitting in his office. When I say his own admission, I heard him say this on McNeil Lehrer, okay? He says, so I was sitting there in my office, and then the president came in. He's a great big guy, you know, and he says, now, Mac, are you going to go up the hill now and get that resolution signed? And I said, says McGeorge Bundy, I said, well, Mr. President, there's some doubt as to whether something really happened. Mac, are you going to go up there and sell that resolution? And Mac says, so I did. Now, listen, McGeorge Bundy was a dean at Harvard. McGeorge Bundy had lots of money and lots of prestige. And yet, when they get in a position like that, when the president tells them to lie to Congress, to start a war, a god-awful war, he goes and he does it, and he admitted doing it.
What about the CIA and in Nixon? Do you have any kind of tale to tell us, a real-life story of that rough period when you were working with the CIA and the whole Watergate situation blasted the whole international community?
Well, yes, I know a good bit about that. Nixon wanted the CIA to cover up what happened at the Watergate. And Vernon Walters, who was the deputy director, an old friend of Nixon's, seemed willing to cooperate. But Helms, Director Helms, whatever his motivation, whether it was altruistic or whether it was once again to protect the agency, told the White House, nothing doing. I'm not going to cover up for what was really a White House operation. So that didn't please Nixon or his folks. And Kissinger, Nixon, and the others were very distraught with the lack of cooperation from CIA to do the cover-up, and we were all glad, at least, well, I can't say all of us, but I had been working on the White House support staff, and I was doing my job just as I would have under any president, but I was very, very happy when Nixon met his eternal reward by having to resign. So those were heady days. We didn't have a good relationship with Nixon. Actually, Kissinger knew all things, of course. And so when we sent things down to Nixon, Kissinger was in the habit of putting copious marginalia on this, like this is nonsense or these people don't know this. So we didn't have a lot of input into policymaking under Nixon, except for one thing. And that was that we thought it would be a good idea if he reached out to China. And this is probably the most important substantive area that I was involved in, because not only was I convinced that the struggle between Russia and China for leadership in the communist world was real, but that it could be exploited. And indeed, Kissinger saw it the same way. And long story short, when Nixon went to China, the Russians got rather anxious about whether China would steal a march on Russia in cultivating a decent relationship with the United States. And that's when the Russians decided, well, maybe strategic arms limitation talks are a good idea. Maybe we should have a quadripartite agreement on Berlin. Maybe we should soothe things down and go toward a détente, a rapprochement with the U.S. And so Kissinger played that card extremely adroitly. And fast forward to today, and you'll see that no longer is it possible to play that card, because in contrast to those days, Russia and China have a very close relationship, a virtual military alliance against us, and that's all because we kept acting very foolishly, alienating both of them and throwing each of them into the other's arms.
What about Jerry Ford? You know that the pundits used to joke about him. He couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time. What were your thoughts about President Ford?
Well, you know, in reality, in retrospect, it was President Rumsfeld and President Cheney. Ford wasn't running anything. Cheney and Rumsfeld were his chiefs of staff. And they did irreparable damage during that brief period, harbinger of things to come. It's a compared to what sort of thing, isn't it? He's better than Nixon. He had a certain amount of respect in Congress and elsewhere. But he was a cipher. He was a tool in the hands of Kissinger, Rumsfeld, and Cheney. And those are three characters that you don't want to be in the hands of.
I'm going to be asking about Rumsfeld later on because you had an interesting confrontation with him about 10 plus years ago. Now, okay, if we can skip to Carter, what about Jimmy and in some of the intelligence, for example, on that ill-fated raid into Iran after the hostage situation? What do you have to say about CIA intelligence on that issue?
Well, I'll say this about Jimmy Carter. He picked a man of integrity to be head of the CIA, Admiral Stansfield Turner. I served under Admiral Turner for a year before I went overseas for a three-year tour. So I missed most of Jimmy Carter's tenure. But I have to say that Stansfield Turner, a four-star admiral in his own right, was a good example of the kind of person you need as head of the intelligence community, someone who didn't have to be part of the president's team, someone who would speak up and tell the truth to power. We haven't had that kind of person since Stansfield Turner, and that was a very long time ago. The rest of the Carter stuff, well, you know, I find it a tragedy that, as I believe to be the case, the hostage situation with respect to Iran was kept going by Reagan, by Bill Casey, and others, so that it could not be resolved because surreptitiously the Republicans told the Iranians, look, we can give you a better deal. Don't release the hostages. And that's one major factor in why Ronald Reagan was able to win.
We're moving along, but before long, you'd leave the White House. I think it was about 1989, about a year before the Persian Gulf War began in August of 1990. What about that event, though, that you saw coming on? What about the event then and now, and what are your thoughts about the first Persian Gulf War vis-a-vis the CIA and the information that they may have had?
Well, I've checked with the people who know about these things, and there was a invasion of Kuwait, of course, and it looked like maybe the Iraqis were going to go into Saudi Arabia as well. In other words, those were not made up things, those were real enough. Now, it was easy for anyone to see that Iraq couldn't be allowed to do those things. The problem is that, as many people may recall, our ambassador in Baghdad, April Glaspie, she kind of gave Saddam Hussein to believe that we were neutral with respect to Kuwait, that we knew that Kuwait was drilling under the territory that Iraq claims, and kind of would wink. At least there's evidence that he got the impression that we would wink and not do much about what he did. So that's one of the complicating factors there. Suffice it to say that the first George Bush, George H.W. Bush, saw this as an opportunity to send, 600,000 troops out that way and have a marvelous war against a country that couldn't defend itself, shoot it up real good, and as he put it after it was all over, defeat the Vietnam syndrome. So that was a big, big deal. And some of the people behind it were people like Wolfowitz and Pearl and those people who were around at the time. And one of the more interesting things that comes out of the terrific victory that Schwarzkopf and the others did there is this. After it was over, one of the generals went to Wolfowitz and said, it was Wesley Clark, actually, four-star general, had been head of NATO. He went to Wolfowitz and said, now, Paul, congratulations on that wonderful victory. Good going, but what would you say is the main lesson that you learned from that? And without hesitation, Wolfowitz said, we could do these things and the Russians won't stop us. Whoa. So that's 1991. Fast forward to 2014, when we stage a coup in the Ukraine, remove the government there, and impose a government that wants to join NATO. Well, now the Russians could stop us, and they did. So 1991, 2014, do the math, but it took that long for Russia to recover to the point where they're willing to defend their own interests against what they saw as the same kind of encroachment that we saw the Russians do in Cuba in 1962.
Following again in sort of a chronological period, we have Bill come in to the picture. Bill Clinton, 8 years of Bill Clinton. Did you see any positive achievements or what were the negs that you saw during the Clinton administration of 8 years?
Well, my first thought with respect to Bill Clinton was that he violated a solemn agreement with the Russians not to move NATO 1 inch east of Germany. He broke that promise, and we know now, we have the documents, we have the cables and the telegrams, State Department and others, that indicate and show beyond any doubt that we promised that if the Russians accepted a reunified Germany, my God, I mean, you have to have some sort of sense for what that meant to the Russians. The Russians lost 27 million people in World War II. And that wasn't the first time they were attacked from the West. And so for them to reverse their policy, which actually was Western policy up till the fall of the wall, the policy to keep the Germans divided, for God's sake, don't let them ever reunify. Well, Gorbachev was persuaded to do that. And what was the quid pro quo? The quid pro quo was a solemn promise made by James Baker, the Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, that NATO would not be moved 1 inch east of Germany. Now, what happened? Well, Bill Clinton, he was afraid of, Bob Dole beating him, and so he, one of the reasons he decided, well, he'd move NATO east would be to get the East European votes from the Midwest and elsewhere, and, you know, it was just so disrespectful and so colossally stupid to move NATO in that direction. You know, George H.W. Bush talked about a unique opportunity for peace and a united Europe from Portugal to Vladivostok, okay? That was possible during a brief period of time. Bill Clinton ruined that, and we end up today with a situation which is almost as parlous as the one that existed when I was watching the Soviet Union with its weaponry and with the contention that existed and now exists even more between our two countries.
You're listening to Episode 8 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Part 1 of a conversation with ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of this episode. We're going to move on, and because, you know, we have 8 years of Bill Clinton, but then we have Bush, too. I'm wondering if you can visualize what your daily briefings would have been if you stayed on in the CIA and gave contradictory information about weapons of mass destruction. Would the neocons have, would Pearl and the rest of the group jumped on you? And as far as that matters, James Clapper, we'll get into James Clapper in a minute, but what would have happened, you know, if you had told the truth?
Well, it's a good question, Jack. I briefed the five principal advisors to President Reagan from 1981 to 85. That was Vice President Bush, Secretary of State Shultz, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, a series of assistants to the President for National Security Affairs, some of whom ended up in jail, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, how did I do that? I did that alone. I did that one-on-one. We were respected. We were valued as experienced analysts who would tell the truth. I'd come in the morning to the operations center at about 5 o'clock, review what happened overnight, get into my car with my driver, and go down and brief these people, depending on who was in town at the time. What did George Tenet do as soon as he wanted to make sure that he hung on during the George W. Bush administration? Well, he did other things like naming CIA headquarters after Bush's father. But worse still, he hitched a ride with the PDB. The PDB is the President's Daily Brief. I was one of those briefers, okay? George Tenet hitched a ride with the PDB briefer so that he could have FaceTime with George W. Bush and maybe get appointed in his own right to be Director of Central Intelligence. So, picture, in answer to your question, picture me sitting down, having talked with the honest analysts, which I had a knack of doing, and I'm sitting at the table there, and George W. Bush says, "So, well, what do we think about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq?" And I would say, in the old days, I'd say, "Well, it's a crock, Mr. President. It's all made up. I know the guys are making it up there in the Pentagon. You want their name?" But now, if I had to look behind me and see the head of the CIA standing behind me, who is a sycophant from the word go, who is a charlatan, who was going to give Bush what he wanted in terms of, quote, justification, end quote, for starting a war, well, that would have been my last day as a PDB briefer. I would have done it anyway. So, you know, he corrupted the agency. You know, it wasn't a mistake, these weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It was fraud, out-and-out fraud. It was manufactured. And, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. After a five-year study, the Senate Intelligence Committee came out with a study on pre-war intelligence on Iraq. And the chairman of that committee announced that the intelligence before Iraq was contradicted, inconsistent, or even non-existent. That's a quote. Now, I ask you, Jack, what does non-existent intelligence look like? This was the result of a five-year study. It was a bipartisan report with two Republicans, among them the later Secretary of Defense from Nebraska, and one from Maine. So it was a bipartisan report saying that the intelligence served up was phony, was non-existent. In other words, they fabricated it. They conjured it out of thin air. Now, this is painful for me because I know those people.
And you know James Clapper, too. And recently you've had kind of a confrontation with Clapper. What about Clapper at that time? What he had kind of a cozy relationship with the neocons. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, Clapper was recommended by Bobby Gates, who you know as a former Secretary of Defense. He was around in Washington as kind of one of the high intelligence officials under the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And then when Rumsfeld came in and he wanted to make a war against Iraq, and Cheney did too, they said, now, how could we persuade the American people that we needed to make a war in Iraq? And WMD, weapons of mass destruction. Let's say that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, getting close to a nuclear bomb. We don't want the first sign of this to be a mushroom cloud. And we need somebody to head the agency that would ordinarily find these weapons of mass destruction and make sure that no one ever says there aren't any. Who should we pick? We know, James Clapper. So they put him out in charge of this agency, called at that time the National Imagery and Mapping Agency. And they said, look, we have all these emigre reports, and they give coordinates. And it's okay for your analysts to look at the coordinates and figure out what's there. It could be, as Chalabi says, it could be a suspected chemical weapons factory. So look at it all, but don't, whatever you do, don't tell us that there's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. So Clapper said, yes, sir. And he performed admirably. And what he says in his book that he was pushing, I had a chance to ask him about these things, he said, you know, the failure, he says it's the failure, I've already said it was the fraud. The failure needs to be put squarely, these are his words, squarely on the shoulders of the administration members who are pushing a narrative of a rogue WMD program in Iraq, and on the intelligence officers, including me, who were so eager to help that we found what wasn't really there. Whoa. He writes it. It's right there, page 90.
You put him up against the wall on that, did you, just recently?
Well, yeah, that was last week. But my point is, you know, don't buy the book, for God's sake. It's not worth it. Yeah. But go to the library, page 99. That's what he says.
Yeah.
The intelligence officers, including me, who were so eager to help that we found what wasn't really there. Wow. And he writes that without any apology. So now what I asked him, I referred to that. I said, you're in charge of imagery analysis. And this, of course, Jack, means more than photos. It means infrared, radar, multispectral imagery. These satellites that we pay billions of dollars on, you know, they would have found weapons of mass destruction if there were any there. So, you know, what I said to him was this. Now, so you, by your own words here, were, quote, so eager to help that we found what wasn't really there. Now, fast forward to 2 years ago, Mr. Clapper. You were working for a different administration than the Obama administration, and they were hell-bent on finding evidence to prove that Trump could not have won the election without Russian help. And so, Mr. Clapper, let me just ask you, did you do the same thing for that? Were you so eager to help that you found what really wasn't there? No. All those people at Carnegie Endowment didn't like that at all. This was impertinent to ask one of the guests there for the Carnegie Institute for Peace. But, you know, he flummoxed around and tried to dance around. But that's what he says in his book. And that's what my colleagues and I, who've looked at the evidence very closely, have concluded with respect to Clapper's role on Russiagate, finding Russian interference when it wasn't really there.
You're listening to Episode 8 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Part 1 of a conversation with ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I'm Jack Gilroy, host of this episode. You know, back in 2006, you were instrumental in encouraging communities to have war crime tribunals. And a lot of this was, you know, kind of focused on some of the truth that was come out of the lies of the Downing Street memo.
Well, that dovetails explicitly with what Clapper recognizes and admits to in his book. Here's Clapper, and I'll get to the Downing Street memo in a second. Quote, "The White House aimed to justify why an invasion of and regime change in Iraq were necessary, with a public narrative that condemned its continued development of weapons of mass destruction and its support to Al-Qaeda." Now, that's what the Downing Street memo said. In other words, as George Tenet was preparing to give Bush and Cheney what they wanted in terms of, quote, justification, end quote, for a war, he briefed the head of British intelligence. The date was July 20th, 2002. The head of MI6, a guy named Sir Richard Dearlove, came to headquarters, and I know some people who were there, to CIA headquarters, and was briefed by George Tenet. Now, why this is important is that 3 days later, no sooner had Dearlove gotten off the plane that he was summoned to Tony Blair's office with the 12 apostles, is what I call them, the 12 senior national security advisors for Blair. And what Dearlove reported, and this is documentary evidence leaked later, was this. George Tenet told me, and I quote, "The U.S. has decided, President Bush has decided, to make war in Iraq for regime change. The war will be justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction." Now, translation from the British, we're going to say that Saddam Hussein has all manner of weapons of mass destruction, and he's likely to give them to the terrorists, to Al-Qaeda, okay? End of interjection there. Last sentence of this paragraph is this. "But the intelligence and the facts are being fixed around the policy." End quote. Whoa! So those were minutes of a meeting in Blair's office on the 23rd of July, 2002. So do the math. The attack on Iraq happened in March of 2003. So this is the whole thing. In other words, you say that there are weapons of mass destruction there and that he's likely to give them to Al-Qaeda. Now, what's interesting here is that Clapper says there was no agreement. There was no evidence of Saddam Hussein's support for Al-Qaeda. Well, that's about the only true thing he says in this thing. There was no evidence, and the CIA, to its credit, fought that. Now, what happened? Well, Colin Powell smelled which way the wind was blowing. And even though he was told that there was no evidence of a connection much less mutual support between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. When he spoke before the UN on the 5th of February 2003, he spoke of the, quote, sinister nexus between al-Qaeda and Iraq, end quote. Now, getting back to Clapper, he's right. There was no evidence of a sinister nexus between al-Qaeda and Iraq, but there was also no evidence of weapons of mass destruction either. And when you think of the billions of dollars and the engineers handsomely paid to construct these very, very sophisticated sensing devices to put up in satellites, as I said, not only for the photographic, but infrared, radar, multispectral. And you find out that Clapper let himself be enlisted into finding, quote, what wasn't really there. Well, you have somebody who's, in my view, committed a very serious crime. And perhaps the most telling thing is he admits this all in his book. He's feted at Carnegie Institute for Peace, and he'll never pay any price for this except. And that's what I ended my piece on. People can see it on my website, raymcgovern.com. When I say except, well, there is international law. Augusto Pinochet ran afoul of it when a warrant from Spain had him confined in Britain for 2 years, okay? The principle is called universal jurisdiction, and it means simply that when your own country won't hold you responsible for a war crime, then every other country that has signed this agreement, and that's most of the countries, are required to detain you and serve you up to the International Court of Justice or wherever, okay? So, why am I saying that? Well, I finished up with a travel tip to Clapper. Look, don't travel abroad to any country bold enough to invoke this principle of universal jurisdiction, because they have a duty to arrest you, okay? Just like they tried to arrest Donald Rumsfeld in October of 2007 when he was in Paris and flew out of that embassy and got on the next plane from Charles de Gaulle Airport, just like they tried to do to George W. Bush.
I'm ready to get into a Donald Rumsfeld question for you, because you came face to face with Donald Rumsfeld. I believe it was May of 2006 when you went down to Atlanta to receive an award that was called the National Civil Liberties Award, which I think somewhere along the line I read that Coretta King had received the previous year. And that same day, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was giving a talk in Atlanta, and somehow you managed to get into the meeting. And there's an amazing YouTube illustration of all that people can easily get onto. It's been looked at by hundreds of thousands of people. But you managed to get into the meeting, and you asked Rumsfeld why he had lied about weapons of mass destruction. And the look on his face as I saw that video, his jaws dropped. It became the top of the news that evening. And could you give us a little bit of a brief on that to let people know what actually went on?
Well, I was down there in Atlanta, as you mentioned, for another reason. And when I heard he was speaking at this very prestigious male, white, Southern defense-friendly think tank, with the help of some very spirited and committed women, I managed to get a ticket. And I got in there about an hour ahead, and I sat right next to the microphone. Well, actually, not right next. There was already the designated first Q&A speaker sitting there. So as he's speaking, I'm seething because he's lying through his teeth and he's talking about this and that. And I was preparing my own speech for later that night at the ACLU awards dinner. But I was going over some of the same information. And when it came to be Q&A, I'll tell you, I knew that I had the goods on him, but I knew I was in a very hostile audience. And so I'm saying to myself, should I do it? And then I thought, McGovern, what would Cindy Sheehan do? What would Anne Wright do? What would the Code Pink women do? What kind of a wuss are you, McGovern? And it was that that got me to stand up. So I asked him why he lied about weapons of mass destruction. He denied that he'd lied. I quoted him back to himself. The same thing with respect to ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. He had described them as bulletproof. Others had described them as scant, others being General Scowcroft. So it went rather well because I could see his attitude there. He was a big Princeton debater, of course, you know, and he's not going to let me win any kind of debate. Unfortunately for him, I had the facts in mind. One other thing on that, which is a real teaching point, I would say, is that on my way out there, I get a call on my cell phone.
Oh, hello, this is Anderson Cooper, Mr. McGovern. You're making quite a stir here in Atlanta. I'd like to have you on my program, but first I want to ask you a quick question.
Well, sure.
Oh, well, how do I say this? Weren't you afraid?
And I said to myself, whoa, here's Anderson Cooper, pretty boy on CNN. Heir to the Vanderbilt fortune. And he's asking me, wasn't I afraid? And so I said, you know, this could be a little fun. I said, Anderson, let me be really candid with you. No, I wasn't afraid. I've briefed defense secretaries in the past. But, you know, what I had done was done my homework. And I had decided to ask him real questions, and it was a real high. It was, Anderson, let me try to persuade you. Try to do that. Do some homework. Ask real questions. You'll find it's a real high.
Well, I'll have my people get in touch with your people.
I said, no, don't do that, Anderson.
Why not?
I don't have any people. Just give me a call back on this line.
Oh, all right.
Now, doesn't he begin his interview of me on air with the same question? The guy has no shame. I mean, doesn't he realize that reporters, journalists, and he's not the worst of them, that they shouldn't be afraid to ask real questions? Doesn't he realize that? So, yeah, that was a real teaching point. Here, one of the real stars was asking me, wasn't I afraid, for God's sake? No, I wasn't afraid. You guys shouldn't be afraid either.
I'm host Jack Gilroy, and you've been listening to Episode 8 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is Part 1 of a conversation with ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern. We spoke on November 21st, 2018. You can find this episode in the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.